My thanks to council, who I see are now approaching tables. Please make yourselves comfortable. I will make just a few quick remarks. We are reaching the fourth argument on our calendar today. It's the fourth of four oral arguments. We have two other matters that we will hear by non-oral submission. Now, I want to note for both lawyers, in case you haven't otherwise become aware of it by just simply sitting in the courtroom. So Judge Klopaki is on the panel today and is participating, but is doing so remotely. And we have the benefit of some technology here. The meeting owl that's positioned in front of the podium is allowing Judge Klopaki to have a visual of the courtroom, of the speaker, and of course to hear you as well as the questions of the bench. And so you may hear questions, of course, from us. Judge Jetson and I, who are sitting at the bench, you will also hear questions from Judge Klopaki, or at least very likely, and that will come through the meeting owl. So if there are any questions about that technology, ask away when those become relevant, but I think we can just proceed as normal. If the marshal would call the fourth case, please.
Now calling case number 822-0627, State of Minnesota respondent, Ms. Abdul Hakim Omar Erbab, appellant.
I know counsel are familiar with our procedures, but I'll just remind you before you start your argument, and we would appreciate it if you stand at the center podium. It will let you see the time. It will also pick up your audio the best. If you will identify yourself for the record, as well as the client you represent, and then just keep an eye on the clock. We do look forward to the conversation. Thank you.
Thanks much, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Sharon Jackson. I'm the Assistant State Public Defender representing Abdul Hakim Omar Erbab in this challenge to his conviction and sentence for attempted aggravated robbery. He's asking the court today to reverse and remand to the district court to consider his motion to withdraw under the fair and just standard. When he made the motion in district court, he cited the manifest injustice standard and argued that it would be a manifest injustice or he would suffer one if the plea wasn't withdrawn because he didn't understand that he could be...
Just a quick question. As I look at the briefs and filings here, it appeared to me, tell me if I'm wrong, that the request to withdraw this plea was made by the appellant and his counsel under the fair and just standard. Is that right?
The motion was made initially under the manifest injustice standard, and then the state clarified for the court that under this court's precedent, it was the fair and just standard that applied. The state then argued the reasons why it was not fair and just, and the state argued why it would be prejudiced if the court would allow Mr. Erbab to withdraw. And then the court offered counsel for Mr. Erbab the opportunity to elaborate, and at that point, his counsel presented additional reasons that it would be fair and just to allow withdrawal. His attorney...
My point is, did you present to the trial court the claim that the standard was manifest injustice?
Initially, yes. And initially, that was the standard that was presented to the court. And later, the defense counsel added that it would be fair and just, or... Backing up, counsel did not say fair and just, but once the fair and just standard was placed before the court and the court asked for additional argument.
Again, am I confused here? Your request to the trial court was to withdraw based upon manifest injustice or fair and just?
The initial request was made, you are correct that the initial request was made under the manifest injustice standard and that later it was made under the fair and just standard. It was the reason we say that it was later made under the fair and just standard is that standard was argued to the district court and then counsel for defense, for the defendant, elaborated that there were other reasons that he should be allowed to withdraw his plea. That was that he had no family in Somalia, and it would be a hardship or horrible for him to return there. So that issue was squarely before...
What it looked to me like your request was under manifest injustice, and then there's some discussion about fair and just, but your only request to the trial court was manifest injustice, And that's the standard of the trial court, too. Am I wrong?
Well, I would say you're wrong, Judge Klopaki, in that the after the court was presented with the fair and just standard, and the state indicated, citing case law, that that was the appropriate standard, the court gave Erbob, his counsel, the opportunity to elaborate. And at that point, his counsel elaborated and gave more reasons why it would be fair and just. And so that issue was squarely before the court. Now, under Lopez, the court, even had that not happened, the fair and just standard would have to be applied. But Erbob's fundamental argument here is not so much that the judge shouldn't have addressed the manifest injustice, but in addition to the manifest injustice standard, it was required under Lopez and under a variety of cases to go on and also consider the motion under the fair and just standard.
So, counsel, if I can just clarify.
I thought Lopez simply said you don't go back to the trial court unless it's affected a substantial right.
That's the second part of the Lopez decision. But the first part of the Lopez decision, where in that case Mr. Lopez never made a motion under the fair and just standard, he made a motion for withdrawal based on his plea being unintelligent, which would be an argument under 1501 that he would suffer a manifest injustice, that the plea was invalid. Lopez never mentioned fair and just. And in Lopez, before getting into what was the proper remedy, the court said, rather than the appropriate standard of a fair and just reason, I'm reading from the wrong part of the opinion. Anyhow, in Lopez, the court went on that the court began by saying that the court abused its discretion by applying the manifest injustice standard. You know, here, we would not be here if the court had addressed the manifest injustice standard and then gone on to also address the fair and just standard, which is what usually is done. But
so, counsel, I need to ask you, if we disagree with your view of the submissions that were made on behalf of your client in district court, in other words, if we conclude that the only relief that was requested by your client was manifest injustice, how does that impact the court's analysis?
Well, if you...
did you forfeit review of fair and just?
We did not forfeit it. Even if this court finds that counsel's additional reasons provided when invited to do so by the court did not place that issue before the court, under Lopez and under a variety of cases, including Cage, which is a case cited in respondent's brief, the court was required to address the fair and just standard.
So you're telling me, and I'm trying to make sure I understand your analysis, right?
Right.
So you're telling me that if I look at Lopez and Cage, I'm going to find a situation where the appellant raised only manifest injustice, and this court remanded and said, oh, no, the district court must review it under a fair and just standard.
In Lopez, the court reversed outright and just allowed the defendant to withdraw his plea. In Cage, the court said, we do not need to remand because there is no evidence in the record showing it would be fair and just. But in both of those cases, there was the reasons given at the plea withdrawal hearing related to the invalidity of the plea and the manifest injustice standard. I don't know that the defendants in those cases said the words manifest injustice like they did here. But for instance, in Cage, this court said that even when a withdrawal motion is made before, when a withdrawal motion is made before sentencing, even where the fair and just standard is not cited, quote, the fair and just standard applies, end quote, because, quote, the defendant may be able to satisfy the lower fair and just standard even if he cannot establish manifest injustice. So there is authority that when a motion is made pre-sentencing, the fair and just standard should be applied, and this court has done that. Now, again, we believe that the record here demonstrates that it wasn't forfeited, because when the state argued that the fair and just standard applied and cited authority to that effect, defense counsel didn't say, no, we're asking that this court only apply the manifest injustice standard. What defense counsel did, it said, yeah, there's other reasons here that justify withdrawal under the fair and just standard, and that is that it would be a great hardship to Mr. Erbob to be sent back to Somalia. He has no family there. I believe he was born in Saudi Arabia, the PSI says, so he's not even Somali. And also that the situation on the ground there was horrible. And what Lopez says is the court is really required to go above and beyond what the reasons that the defendant advances. Lopez says that the court has to consider the full context of the record at the time of the entry of the plea.
So as we look at the record, Ms. Jacks, does it matter at all or the fact that your client made the motion to withdraw his plea after the sentencing hearing was scheduled when he didn't appear? I mean, do you see what I'm saying? So, I mean, he made it after the sentencing hearing, which he didn't appear. Does that factor into our analysis, looking at all these circumstances, or not?
I don't think it does, because when the courts, when the decisions speak to pre-sentencing, they're speaking to the actual sentencing, like have you received a sentence yet or not, not to whether or not you appeared for a sentencing and it had to be rescheduled. Now, could that be one factor that the court considers, that there was a three-month period that he was on the lam? I guess the court could consider that to determine whether or not it was fair and just. But in general, when you're looking at is it fair and just to allow withdrawal, I think you look at the individual's life and what happened at the plea hearing. That's why Lopez says look at the full context of what happened at the plea hearing. Even if that factor would weigh against Mr. Erbob, there are multiple factors that weigh in favor of him. The court had the PSI, and the PSI indicated that he had mental health issues, he had PTSD, depression, anxiety, and they weren't being treated. And he sat in jail during a worldwide pandemic for 3 months, suffering the stress of that, of the fear of contracting COVID, of not being able to see family, of having no movement within the jail, while he was suffering from those mental health issues. Those all came to light, it appears, when he was in treatment post-plea. The PSI says he saw a psychologist at that point, and so and received medication then. So the fact that he had earlier said at the plea hearing that he didn't have any mental health issues, that might have been his belief at that time, but a professional deemed that, in fact, he did. So the court was required to consider those circumstances. The court also had before it the fact that he had an infant daughter, U.S. citizen, here, and that if he were not allowed to withdraw his plea and at least go to trial, where there would be some hope that he could stay in the United States, he would be separated from his infant daughter. So there are a wide variety of factors here that the court didn't consider, and we're just asking that it be remanded to give the district court the opportunity to consider all of those factors. At that time, I would say it would not be an abuse of discretion for the district court to consider some of Mr. Erbob's actions prior to that, because it is a totality of the circumstances test. But it is primarily, the fundamental issue is that the court has that discretion, and when a court doesn't exercise its discretion, that's an abuse of discretion. So what we're asking for here is that the court reverse and remand and give the district court its opportunity to address the issue that the parties put before it at the sentencing hearing. And if the court has no further questions, we would just ask that you reverse and remand.
All right, and so I assume you're proceeding on the second issue primarily on the briefs.
Yes, although I'm happy to talk about that. As to the second issue, if the court doesn't reverse and remand for withdrawal, then we'd ask that you reverse and remand for a sentence correction. In the way that the court calculated Mr. Erbob's sentence, it did not follow the plain language of the enhancement provision that applies here. if you look at the...
So my question on the second issue has to go to that enhancement provision you just alluded to. So in the enhancement provision, I think the language is, and let me just see if I can, and feel free to double-check me. I'm sure you have it available,
I've
too.
I've got it right in front of me here.
It says that the presumptive fixed sentence for the current offense is kind of the baseline, right?
Correct.
And so I think the question is what is meant in the guidelines by the presumptive fixed sentence, because here, as with most offenses, we actually had a range within the presumptive sentence, right? It's not fixed, truly, in that it's not one number. It's a range of numbers is actually the fixed sentence, right?
Correct. I believe that's
so
the case.
I'm just curious how you interpret that, because, of course, we all know that the enhancement is an addition, in this case, of 6 months. So that 6 months, presumably when it's added, gets added to a range as opposed to one number.
Right.
But, I mean, the argument I saw briefed by both lawyers was assuming that there was a number, and there isn't a number.
Well, that's a good point, Your Honor, and I don't know that I have a satisfactory answer for that. I would say that, you know, it appeared here that the court was looking at the middle of the box. Defense had asked for at low end of the box, and the calculation, the PSI indicated middle of the box, and that's sort of where the numbers came from.
The judge never said, though, middle of the box, at least not that I could see in the transcript.
The judge never said that expressly.
Okay. And I mean, for this court, when a judge has issued and imposed a guideline sentence and doesn't, you know, give any indication of a misunderstanding other than that, in fact, the judge did impose a guideline sentence, I'm confused where we would see the abuse of discretion.
I take your point. And we're going by the fact that, you know, the PSI recommended middle of the box. And so and that is the general course, right? Normally when a judge is giving the low end of the box, the judge says, I'm sentencing you to the low end of the box. When the judge is sentencing to the high end of the box, the judge says that. And so the middle of the box is always the presumed sentence, right? Mm-hmm. And what it says is that the court is to determine that in sentence as determined in Section 2C. And Section 2C tells the court how to find the sentence for the underlying offense, not for the convicted offense. And after that, the word shall follows directly after that. And so the plain reading of that provision... Oh, I see my time is up.
It's okay. Go ahead and finish your answer, and then, as you know, if you want to say more later, you've got a rebuttal.
I'll reserve any further comments for rebuttal.
Okay. That's fine. And please give some thought to that question, and if you come up
absolutely.
With something different, we'd appreciate it. So, counsel for respondent, we're ready for you.
May it please the court. My name is Jeffrey Wald, and I represent respondent State of Minnesota in this appeal. Appellant makes two arguments in this appeal. First, that Judge Harris abused his discretion in denying his motion to withdraw his plea. And second, that he is entitled to 3 months off his 45-month guidelines prison sentence because Judge Harris erroneously calculated the second or subsequent severe violent offense enhancement. This court should now deny appellant's arguments. Appellant is not entitled to plea withdrawal. Contrary to his claims, he was thoroughly advised of the possible immigration consequences of pleading guilty and expressly disclaimed feeling pressured or coerced into pleading guilty. Judge Harris correctly deny the only argument that appellant raised, concluding there was no manifest injustice. Appellant's sentencing argument also lacks merit. He effectively...
Well, before you move on, counsel, would you please address the fair and just standard as argued by appellant's counsel?
Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, that was raised by the state's attorney during the sentencing hearing, that standard, so...
The standard, yes, Your Honor. The state prosecutor did raise the fair and just standard, But I would disagree with appellant's counsel that appellant ever raised the fair and just standard.
Well, I think your point is that the argument that was made to the district court included arguments specifically geared to the fair and just standard, such as the hardship of deportation. You've already argued that defendant, this Mr. Erbob in this case, was aware of the immigration consequences of his plea. The fair and just standard, though, would actually examine the harshness of actual deportation. Arguably. I'm just saying that is an argument that could be made.
It's certainly an argument that could have been made but was not made to Judge Harris at the district court by appellant or appellant's counsel. And I'm holding in my hand the one-page notice of motion and motion for plea.
I'm talking
withdrawal.
About the transcript at the hearing, not about the written motion.
Yes, and the transcript at the hearing also mentioned only the manifest injustice standard from appellant. And even after the state had raised or had offered the fair and just reasons, including prejudice to the state, why there should not be plea withdrawal, the appellant only made maybe one or two line argument in response to that, namely that it would be a hardship to be deported to Somalia. The state's position...
So help me out. How does that argument, that hardship of being deported to Somalia, how does that respond to the manifest injustice standard?
I think that it could fall within that it would be a manifest injustice to be deported to a country where he, I don't know that he used the word had no family, but that where it would be a hardship to be deported to that country. Ultimately, Your Honor, the state, its initial argument is that this was never raised. The fair and just standard was never raised before the district court. But even if it was raised, or even if Judge Harris had some sort of an obligation to sua sponte, address fair and just reasons for plea withdrawal, it's still very clear, the case law, and I'm quoting here from my brief, the Absalon decision, which says that, and I'm looking for that, but ultimately that the district court is to look at the arguments that are raised before it, and does not abuse. Here it's on page 9 of my brief. It says the district court does not abuse its discretion in denying a pre-sentence motion to withdraw a guilty plea if, quote, nothing objectively in the record suggests that the defendant failed to comprehend the nature, purpose, and consequences of the plea, end quote. And here, Judge Harris adequately addressed all of the reasons that appellant made for requesting plea withdrawal. He addressed the argument that he didn't understand the nature of the plea, that he might be deported, discrediting that testimony, both because of the plea petition, which expressly stated that he might be deported as a consequence of his felony plea, as well as looking at Exhibit 1 of the state's response to the motion, which submitted 3 prior plea petitions, which also had that same language in it. And the court also noted that appellant at the plea hearing had noted that he'd gone over the plea petition line by line, that he didn't have any further questions, and that he was satisfied with his plea of guilty. But
if it was error to apply the manifest injustice standard, and then we have to get to whether this affected appellant's substantial rights, what troubles me about that, I mean, I understand what you're saying is all correct, is that, you know, in the plea hearing, appellant's counsel didn't directly ask him if he understood he could face deportation after entering. I mean, and we often and usually see that, at least, you know, as opposed to having it just in the plea petition itself. So why shouldn't that cause us to say, if we believe it was error, then we need to send it back, as opposed to just saying, even if error didn't affect his substantial rights?
Well, because it would require this court to ignore the plea petition and to ignore his appellant's own testimony that he went over the plea petition line by line and that he understood everything in the plea petition and that he did not have any questions. And I cite cases precedential cases. It says that this court is not going to disregard or ignore an appellant's own testimony.
But given the, you know, the backdrop of the immigration, you know, the concerns about immigration consequences to pleas, shouldn't we look at, I mean, at this, that set of questions a little differently than just, well, it was in the plea petition?
Could it be best practice to have an oral colloquy on the record? Perhaps. But is there any case law that has required that? Not that I'm aware of. Here there is a plea petition as well as Exhibit 1 from the sentencing hearing that indicated this was appellant's fourth felony plea, so fourth time that he had went over that identical language. And Judge Harris, although he didn't use the words, look, I find your testimony or your argument incredible, he noted that, look, I find it hard to believe. What I think is really going on here is you pled guilty, you then went to treatment, and you absconded from treatment, and so you're now potentially looking at a prison sentence. And so you messed up, and it looks like now what you're looking to do is to get out of your plea because of the consequences of that unfortunate decision. So Judge Harris addressed the argument about the chief argument that was made, that he was potentially facing deportation, and addressed the argument that he was under great stress at the time, noting that, look, once again, at the plea, you disclaimed that you were being pressured or coerced into pleading guilty, and at the time of the plea, Judge Harris had found that he knowingly and voluntarily entered his plea. And that there was no argument that was made. It was appellant's burden to provide the reasons, whether those were manifest injustice reasons or fair and just reasons. It was his burden to provide those reasons to Judge Harris. Judge Harris examined the arguments that were made to him and denied them. And there was no abuse of discretion. And I cite cases that ultimately this is a harmless error standard. That, sure, did Judge Harris use the magic words, there are no fair and just reasons to support plea withdrawal? No, he didn't use those words. But I cite case law that the district court is not required to use those magic words. What he's required to do is to address the arguments that are before him and to decide whether, and to look in the totality of the circumstances, whether there are grounds to support plea withdrawal. And here, Judge Harris did that and did not find those reasons, and that was not an abuse of discretion. In my remaining 5 minutes, I'd just like to turn to the sentencing issue for a moment and respond first to Judge Bradfold's question about the range of sentences. And I do make that argument in my brief. It's my initial argument about the sentence on page 13 and 14 of the brief, and it's simply that regardless of whether you agree with the appellant's sentencing argument or the state's position on the sentencing enhancement at issue, under both interpretations of the guidelines, appellant received a guideline sentence. Whether that was a 42-month sentence or a 45-month sentence, it was well within the guidelines. I believe under appellant's interpretation, the high end of the box would be 49.5 months. The low end of the box would be 36.5 months. There's a guideline sentence here. Judge Harris never said that he was imposing a middle of the box sentence or high end of the box or low end of the box. He imposed the sentence within the guidelines. And it's this court's precedent that generally a guideline sentence is not even reviewed.
So, Mr. Wald, if I may, I'm looking at footnote 9 in your brief where you're noting that, and we appreciate your attention to our rules where you can ask us to issue a precedential opinion, so thank you
yes
for that, but noting that this case presents a novel guidelines interpretation issue that has statewide impact and encourages us to publish in this matter, but if we agree with you on the first, that this is a guideline sentence, then that would be really an advisory opinion, right?
Yes, Your Honor, I appreciate that. That's only if you're going to reach the ultimate ultimate issue. If you determine that, look, this is a guidelines issue, we don't really need to get into the trickier, thornier issue of interpreting the guidelines and specifically 2G14B, then at that point, I don't see a reason or a need to publish or make precedential this opinion. But if this court does get into the interpretation of the guidelines, I just want to emphasize, and once again, this goes back to Judge Bradfold's question, what 2G14B provides, the key language is you need to find the presumptive fixed sentence for the current offense. Now, appellant hinges most of his argument on the next phrase, as determined in Section 2C. But you can't find a sentence, a presumptive sentence for an offense, for an attempt in Section 2C alone. You need to look at the guidelines as a whole. Section 2C will give you the presumptive sentence for a completed offense. And then to find the presumptive fixed sentence for an attempt, you need to refer to Section 2G2, which then tells you to have what you found in 2C. And so that's what's key, the presumptive fixed sentence for the current offense. The current offense here is attempted aggravated robbery. The presumptive current offense for appellant's offense is not the 70-some months, but it's 39 and a half, or I think it's 39 and a half, which is the sentence for attempt. Attempt is its own separate offense. It's its own crime. And so that's the chief issue with appellant's argument, is emphasizing Section 2C, which you can't emphasize that alone. You must refer to 2C. And then secondly, that Section 2G14B on its own terms says that if the current severe violent offense is an attempt under Minnesota statute, Section 60917, which we have here, the increase shall be one half the number of months stated. So a very plain language reading says, well, one half of 12 is 6. One half of 12 is not 3. Unless there's any further question from the panel on either issue, I would simply ask that this court affirm appellant's sentence and his conviction. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
With respect to the first issue, I just point the court to page 7 of the sentencing transcript after the state makes its full-blown argument about the fair and just standard and cites this court's published case law. The court asks Mr. Erbob's counsel if she has a response to that, at which point she does say he has no family in Somalia and it would be really horrible for him to be deported back there. So again, based on what the state argued, based on what the defense added at that point, that issue was squarely before the district court. And while it may have been okay to address the manifest injustice standard, the court was required to go on and address the fair and just standard. The state's relying on the Abdisalan opinion for this broad holding that if a person understands what they're doing when they plead guilty, it's never fair and just to allow them to withdraw their plea. And that's not what that case says. That is a statement that was made, the quote that was read is a statement that was made in the case with respect to one of the bases that the defendant had provided to withdraw his plea. He had indicated he didn't understand English. And the court said, he says he doesn't understand English, but the record shows he did understand English. So given that he understood, that's not a fair and just basis. The only time this court doesn't send back a case for consideration under the fair and just standard is where the record doesn't support the reasons given or the entire context is not supported in the record that it could be fair and just, or that a judge would have the discretion to find that it was a fair and just. And that's not the case here because the record supports all of the reasons given. The state itself concedes that he is looking at deportation to Somalia. The record supports that he has no family there. The record supports he has a U.S. citizen daughter here. The record supports that he has a variety of mental health issues that weren't being treated at the time that he pled guilty, and they hadn't been treated for 3 months prior to that while he sat in jail during a worldwide pandemic. So there are a lot of, unlike Abdesalan or Cage or Carson, these unpublished cases that the state's relying on, here there are, in fact, enough factors that probably, as in Lopez, you could, as a matter of law, determine that it would be fair and just. But we're not asking for that here. We're just asking to give Judge Harris the opportunity to consider those factors. It is not true that, in effect, he did consider them and just didn't say fair and just. On page 8 of the sentencing transcript, the judge expressly says, I'm not going to consider any other issues. There may be other reasons why you want to withdraw, but I'm not going to get into those. The court expressly said manifest injustice, and I think it's clear from the record that that's the standard that was applied. As to the sentence and whether or not he was intending to impose middle of the box, I would just point you to page 12 of the sentencing transcripts. Judge doesn't expressly say middle of the box, but the judge does say that, refers heavily to the PSI when denying the motion for a departure and denying the motion for low end of the box. So, again, not crystal clear, but I think also when you look at the PSI, it expressly says 45 months and then says that the sentence was automatically calculated and there may be errors. You know, that's the boilerplate language that's in the PSI. And, the crux of our argument is that the state is, or the court here and the state's reading of that provision excises that sentence as determined, or that phrase as determined, in Section 2C from that provision, and courts aren't permitted to do that. So we just ask that you reverse and remand to allow Judge Harris to consider this motion under the Fair and Just Status, or in the alternative to order that he reconsider his sentence. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thanks to both lawyers in this case. The matter has been well briefed and well argued. We very much appreciate your submissions to the court. The case is now submitted to us for a decision, and we will issue a decision within the statutory time frame. So with that, we have concluded our oral argument calendar for today, and the court will be in recess. Thank you.